You are listening to another Voice of Freedom broadcast, financed through the free will donations of listeners like yourself. I'm Ernst Sundel, your host and moderator. The opinions expressed by our guests or in editorials and stories are always those of the originators. We believe that personal opinions freely expressed are not a danger to any democratic society. We don't have to agree with any or all of the opinions expressed by others. We owe it to ourselves, however, to listen, to evaluate, and to possibly learn something new or different in the process. You may reach us at 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1, telephone 1-416-922-9850. And now we have another interesting program for you. I'm Ernst Sundel from another Voice of Freedom program. Today I have an interesting topic that might sound a little dry at first, but it really is a very important issue. It has to do with what the state of freedom is like in Canada and of course also in the Western world, because Canada is in the world of the global village, just another house in the village. The problems that are faced by Canada and by people in Canada are basically the same that are faced in the United States, to a lesser degree, in European countries, to a greater degree, and there, depending on where you live, like Germany or Austria or France, to an extreme degree, in Switzerland, to a much lesser degree, and in Belgium, to no degree, because there, freedom of speech is far safer in Belgium and Switzerland than it is, for instance, in Germany, Austria, and France, where the concept is really unknown, it turns out to be, where the rights to freedom of speech exist on paper in some kind of a fata morgana, but not in effect in reality. As many people, many professors, school teachers, writers, and ordinary political organizers have found out to their dismay. In Canada, I think I can claim for myself the honor and distinction, not the dubious honor, but the honor and distinction for having put up the most protracted battle for freedom of speech in the modern history of Canada, with a 9-year legal battle, because I had dared to publish, not to write, to publish, to reprint, an Englishman's writing, a small 30,000 word booklet called Did 6 Million Really Die? This trial created what we monitored ourselves, 33 hours of prime time television specials and newscasts in the Canadian media, and untold millions of words that were published about me, my ideas, the content of the booklet, the witnesses that I brought into the courtrooms, both for the government, the prosecution, and for the defense, meaning by myself. In two celebrated high-profile trials, in which I was arrested, jailed, bombed, beaten, spat at, handcuffed, brought to jail in police vans, stripped stark naked in front of hundreds of people, put into solitary confinement, and spat at in prisons, and vilified in the media by politicians in parliament, and so on. Misrepresented wherever you could by school teachers and by columnists. Nevertheless, after 9 years, I prevailed, because the Supreme Court of Canada, in a magnificent decision, on the 27th of August, 1992, ruled in my case, and I quote from a Supreme Court précis, meaning a condensation of the 141-page judgment, Per La Forêt, Le Redoubé, Sopinka, and McLachlan J.J., these were the judges that wrote this decision. Section 181 of the Canadian Criminal Code, under which I was charged, of the code infringes the guarantee of freedom of expression. Section 2B of the Charter of Rights, which is like the Bill of Rights in the United States, protects the right of a minority to express its view, however unpopular it might be. All communications which convey or attempt to convey meaning are protected by Section 2B, unless the physical form by which the communication is made, for example, a violent act, excludes protection. The content of the communication is irrelevant. The purpose of the guarantee is to permit free expression to the end of promoting truth, political or social participation, and self-fulfillment. That purpose extends to the protection of minority beliefs, which the majority regards as wrong or false. Section 181, which may subject a person to criminal conviction and potential imprisonment because of words he published, has undeniably the effect of restricting freedom of expression and therefore imposes a limit on Section 2B. As the victim, the person that was charged, that was arrested, that was handcuffed, that was jailed and convicted and vilified, this document by the Supreme Court, of course, was belated acknowledgement that I was right all along, that I was merely practicing my constitutionally guaranteed rights of freedom of expression in this country of Canada. Now, of course, what I said was not popular, especially not popular with a very well-organized, vociferous, loud, some say even shrill minority, the Holocaust lobby. Those who promote the idea that Jews have this copyright on pain, that they were the only people in history that really suffered in some mega Holocaust, some mega persecution. I, as a German person, say it simply does not hold up to scrutiny once you get digging into it. Because remember, at one time I used to believe the same thing. I believed in the Holocaust story as fervently until 1959 as I believed in the Tooth Fairy, the Easter Bunny, and Santa Claus when I was a little boy. But as I grew into maturity as a boy, I left that belief behind me, just like now I left behind me the belief that 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. Now, do you think I blame my mother for being a diabolical liar, or my aunts and my uncles or my friends or other people? No. It was a culture myth. We all believed it. All little kids believed it. And boy, I remember the wonder when the Christmas bells were ringing and the candles on the tree smelled really nice. Real candle, not electric candles like we have today. And the gifts were opened and the carols were sung and so on. It was wonderful. Santa Claus was really real to me. I didn't suffer trauma because I dumped that belief. And I did not ultimately suffer a damaged psyche after I dumped my equally false belief that 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust. I had matured. Canada and America were good to me because this is a place where there is far more freedom, far many more documents available, and where people are not yet as angst-ridden, or at least were not, in the 60s when I started my quest for personal self-liberation or self-deprogramming from the cult of the Holocaust. So I am forever going to be grateful to North America and to the English and French languages that they set me free, and to Canadians who helped free me from this monkey on my back. Now, I was the victim for 9 years, but that there were august, meaning great minds in Canada, also observing what was happening to the country, especially to intellectual freedom, to the intellectual climate, I can prove to you by some very startling evidence. And undoubtedly, my trial had a great deal to do with alerting and shaping the thinking of the people that I am going to quote to you. It is an article in the Vancouver Sun of September 27th, 1993. And the writer of the article is Stephen Bindman. Now, Stephen Bindman and I go back for a long time. Stephen Bindman covered for the Ottawa Citizen my postal tribunal hearing when the Canadian government had removed my rights to receive mail or to send out mail. Now remember, I am a writer, a publisher. I live by ideas and by sharing these ideas with others. And I remember this tall, handsome, young Jewish fellow in Ottawa during the postal hearings kind of questioning me critically and quizzically, and we were kind of squaring off intellectually why I should have the right or should not have the right to have my mail rights back. Well, as it turns out, the government of the day got slapped on the wrists by their own hand-selected postal tribunal, which they set up because I had a right under the law in Canada to appeal this draconian measure of yanking my mail rights, and I won. And then the grotesque thing happened. For 16 years, nobody would allow me to actually read the decision. I had to go to court over and over again to get the right to actually get to see the decision in that case. All I was informed with by a postal inspector was, oh, you can have your mail back. They brought three sacks of mail with stale checks, and I was back in business. However, Stephen Bindman covered that particular postal hearing so many, many years ago in the early 80s. And now he has an article in the Vancouver Sun, September 27, 1993, and he quotes none other than the Chief Justice of Canada, Antonio Lemaire. And I want to share that we are precise what Chief Justice Antonio Lemaire said. Ottawa, Dateline, Southern News. Don't try to be popular. Just do the right thing. That's the advice Canada's Chief Justice has for lower court judges across the country. Chief Justice Antonio Lemaire of the Supreme Court of Canada told a weekend conference he is concerned about the pressure sometimes placed on judges by interest groups and the media. Lemaire said he is nervous about a judge who is popular, but, and he quotes, I despair of one who wants to be popular. We are given our independence and our security of tenure, exceptional in this day and age, so we can do the right thing, even when it is unpopular. End of quote. He told the annual conference of the Canadian Association of Provincial Court Judges in St. John's, Newfoundland. Quote, the job of the judge is not to embrace an ideology, but to render a fair judgment. A judge must not risk convicting an innocent person today because other judges have acquitted guilty persons in the past. End of quote. A copy of Lemaire's remarks was released by his Ottawa office. The Chief Justice complained that the concept of judicial independence, a, quote, fundamental principle of our system of justice, end of quote, is still met with increasing public suspicion. He urged judges to let the public better understand why judicial independence is so important and said that the judiciary is, quote, a service organization, not a private club, end of quote. Quote, People often have the impression that some claims of judicial independence are mere assertions by judges of privileges and immunities. They often perceive these as more concerned with protection of the judge than with the public interest. End of quote. As an example of this cynicism, Lemaire cited the recent report of a Canadian Bar Association task force on women in the legal profession that said the principle, quote, may be being used as a cloak for conduct it was never intended to address, end of quote. Judicial independence has traditionally been used by judges to resist calls for mandatory gender sensitivity courses and changes to the way judges are disciplined. But Lemaire stressed that much needed reforms to the legal system should not be rejected based on, quote, trivial or instinctive, end of quote, appeals to judicial independence, quote, where the public interest requires it, we should lead the way to reform. We judges are the stewards of the great principles of the rule of law, not merely of the status quo. The dictates of judicial independence and the preservation of the status quo should not be confused, let alone be equated. End of quote. Now, this was the Chief Justice of Canada ringing the alarm bells, where he was saying that we had judges that wanted to be popular and try to make decisions based on what interests groups and what the media expected of them. Now, believe me, when I was in that courtroom during my court hearings, especially the two lower court judges, I don't think you needed to be a rocket scientist or a Nobel Prize winner to see what was going on in that courtroom. How prosecutors were beset by the Holocaust lobbyists, unabashedly, unashamedly handed documents, books, how they later bragged in newspaper columns that they delivered the films from the Jewish Film Board, that they delivered the witnesses to the Crown, that they suggested the expert witnesses, and so on. That's what I, the victim, experienced, and I think that's what Chief Justice Lemaire is talking about. But we have another wonderful judge in Canada, another Supreme Court justice, a man of Ukrainian background. His name is John Sopinka. And he, again, on October the 28th, 1993, gave a speech, and it is headlined in the Montreal Gazette, "Against Political Correctness." Not saying the unpalatable poses greater a threat to free speech than any other government decree, Supreme Court Justice says, and the author of this article is Jeff Baker. "Political correctness poses a greater threat to freedom of speech than any government undertaking," Supreme Court Justice John Sopinka said yesterday. Quote, "We must still rely on the common sense of public opinion to stand up for the right to say things, no matter how unpalatable they may seem," end of quote. Justice Sopinka told a group of 150 students and professors in a speech at Concordia University. By the way, I went to Concordia University. I was the assistant editor of the student paper there in the middle 60s. So I naturally was kind of warmed when I heard that he spoke at that particular university, because I remember it so well. He says, quote, "The greatest threat to free speech no longer comes from the state, but from within ourselves. Public speaking appearances by judges, especially those on Canada's highest court, are rare, and the practice is often shunned within the judicial community. But Sopinka has long defended his personal right to speak out on issues, even at a time when the opinions of some judges and their actions on the bench are being criticized as insensitive by feminist and minority groups. At yesterday's speech organized by political science students, Sopinka stressed the need for the legal system to deal with each individual in a fair manner. But he also warned that if judges are forced to work under constant fear of being rebuked for every action and utterance that falls from their bench, it, quote, may result in decisions that are politically correct, but may not be legally and factually correct." Sopinka described how attacks on free speech can be made by the courts, such as outlawing child pornography or through civil libel and slander suits. But he labeled political correctness as the most subtle attack of all. He said some groups of feminists, gays, and visible minorities are not content with having their views expressed, but demand that contrary views be suppressed. I repeat that for you. That's a direct quote from Justice Sopinka, but demand that contrary views be suppressed. Sopinka quoted Harvard Law professor and noted criminal lawyer Alan Dershowitz as having recently complained that he feels a reluctance on the part of his students to, quote, Dershowitz, "experiment with unorthodox ideas," end of quote. Warning that, quote, "what may be thought to be correct today may be thought to be incorrect tomorrow," end of quote. Sopinka said he too feared most individuals will be reluctant to stand up for what they believe in because they are afraid of mass criticism. So, that is what Justice Opinka said. He concludes in this article, quote, "I am concerned about the influence this will have on the administration of justice," end of quote, he said. Besides juries, Opinka said, crowds of chanting people gathered on courthouse steps potentially could make prosecutors reluctant to press charges in certain cases where they are warranted. Now, as one of the victims of this kind of process of mass criticism by the media, of judges who were obviously listening to the chants outside the courthouse, because there were hundreds, at one time 400 demonstrators who had choruses, "kill him, kill him, kill him," meaning me, of massive police presence, up to 100 police, where I had to arrive in court wearing hard hats, knocked down when I had 3 bodyguards, hit over the head when I had 12 bodyguards, finally got into the court when I had 45 bodyguards and 100 police protecting me from getting into the court because I had a different opinion of what Justice Opinka said. What may be thought to be correct today may be thought to be incorrect tomorrow. Namely, the Holocaust, as we have been told, is not correct, I say, and I'm going to be proven correct tomorrow. Now, Justice Opinka was one of the justices who wrote my favorable judgment in my case. Why am I dwelling on this? Because there is a constant effort in the Canadian media and also in the American media, and unfortunately in Europe, the steamroller has already rolled over most of the justices, rolled over most of the parliamentarians, and kind of ensnared and imprisoned mentally the media of most of Europe, except for Belgium and France. In Canada, we have this pernicious activity where the legislature of British Columbia under the socialist government has passed a private, meaning a provincial hate law that is so restrictive that writers, broadcasters, and publishers out there quake in their boots. And of course, having been one that has been chilled, in quote, by the powerful jackboot of the judiciary and the police, certainly I know what it feels like for these writers and broadcasters with one eye and ear looking over the shoulder whether Big Brother was watching them. So in Ontario, a Jewish member of parliament for the Conservative Party called Charles Harnick proposed a bill, Bill 56, which was equally draconian, and he had the nerve in George Orwell terms to call it an act to protect the civil rights of persons in Ontario. It was not an act to protect the civil rights. It was an act to deny the civil rights of the people of Ontario. It was so draconian that it would have found a writer that said something that some people might not have liked, like me saying the Holocaust is exaggerated, that some of these people are despicable liars, would have cost me $10,000 just because I hurt their feeling. Why? Because the bill had a clause in it that said that damage did not have to be proven by the victim. Can you imagine that? And since I'm the president of Samizdat Publishers Limited, my company could have been fined another $50,000. But if that was not enough, a court judge with this law could have put out an injunction preventing me, my publishing house, any other writers from my publishing house, any broadcasters, to have a broadcast like this. And I think this is what Chief Justice Lemaire and what Justice Opinka were afraid of. Enter the self-appointed censors in Canada and, of course, also in the United States and around the world. We have the B'nai-B'rith Covenant, November 11, 1993, where the B'nai-B'rith National Chair for the Institute for International Affairs and B'nai-B'rith Canada President-elect David Lerner write, "Listen to German Ambassador to Canada, Dr. Hans-Günther Sulima, at a luncheon. Headline, Zündel on Germany's list. Wow, when I read that, I looked in here and I read this most incredible thing, where the German ambassador to Canada says that he believes that Zündel has committed so many new offenses since the Supreme Court decision that he hopes that they will be grounds for a new prosecution. Now here is this German ambassador representing one of the most repressive, undemocratic regimes on the planet Earth today, wanting to import into peaceful, law-abiding, constitutional, human rights-affirming Canada his own police state tactics in Germany. Well, am I glad to say that whatever my breath was trying to get out of it, they didn't succeed. However, there's another article in the Bergen City, New Jersey Record, Wednesday, January 6, 1993, and it quotes headline, New Jersey bias crime chief to train Toronto police. Get that, eh? This man was the man who set up, according to the Canadian Jewish News, Thursday, January 27, 1994, special police unit on guard against hate crimes, propaganda. And another headline, New Jersey officer lauds Toronto. Quote, Toronto, Paul Goldenberg has seen it all. A career cop with 13 years experience, he's traveled several times to jurisdictions in the United States and even visited Israel to help local police get a handle on the growing incidents of crime. He has been to Toronto, apparently, 6 times. So this man, Goldenberg, is hardly Czechoslovakian. He is Jewish. And Mr. Goldenberg knows nothing better than to come to Toronto at taxpayers' expense and let his own personalist bias hang out all over the paper. And here's what he says. He came to Toronto and he said that during the 5-day seminar, Goldenberg also will meet with members of Canada's domestic and foreign intelligence services who are concerned by evidence that some hate groups in Canada have international ties. Quote, we know that some of the hate literature in Ontario, printed in Ontario, is in fact making its way to Germany, which has been plagued by rightist violence, Goldenberg said. He said much of the information concerns revisionist views of the Holocaust that downplay or deny that Jews and others were exterminated in death camps. Well, let me tell you something. Here is a famous cop trying to circumvent or to impress his own personal prejudices or ignorance about history to end up putting people in jail like Ernst Zündel, because I do not believe in his Jewish tribal history. Well, Chief Justice Lemire and Justice Opinka have a few words for him. This is a place where the Constitution is alive and well, and we are going to teach these self-appointed censors a lesson in freedom of speech. I am Ernst Zündel of the Voice of Freedom at 206 Carlton Street in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1. I repeat, Ernst Zündel, 206 Carlton Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, M5A2L1. Telephone 416-922-9850. Auf Wiedersehen.